This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. So let's start out by welcoming Grant Morgan, who is one of the new words. It's one person, wordsmith, I guess is the word I was trying to think of at the moment there. He's a reporter for the Post Tribune, and he is covering, among other things, but primarily Lake County government these days. Grant, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Hey, how you doing, Mr. Nolte? Thanks for having me.
I'm fine. Thank you very much. We'll start in first with the story that is out there, including the picture of Tracy Page's driveway or the entrance to his driveway. It's all part of the story that you put out there and having a chance to talk with friends and neighbors of his who had something to say about the guilty verdict that came down in the trial of the person who was accused of slaying Tracy Page. Tell us a little bit about your encounter with the neighbors and friends of Tracy Page and what you had to say in the story.
Sure thing. First, I just wanted to give a quick thank you to a fellow reporter of mine, Michelle Quinn. She's helped me out a lot with this, and her help was invaluable. But to your question, so I was in the trial, I think it was on the second day, and I talked to a woman who was standing outside of it. I asked her why she was there. She said she was a 30-plus year colleague of Mr. Page's. And, you know, that wasn't unusual to have people showing up just because they knew him, had worked with him. He was that kind of a guy. And so I asked her what her story was, and she gave me some information. She said, there's one more thing that you got to know about him, and it happened the day of the incident. A few hours afterward, some coworkers had gathered in Mr. Page's home to sort of comfort Page's husband. Mm-hmm. And she walked down the driveway to close the gates up. She found some reporters there. She found some people there. And there was one woman there with a yellow bouquet of flowers. And she said, hey, can you take this up to the house? And the woman who I talked to said, yeah, sure. Tell me your name so I can say who it was from. And the woman said, no, you don't get my name. This is from all of us neighbors. And I think that kind of illustrates the kind of guy that Mr. Page was to many people in the area.
You discovered an awful lot about Tracy Page and had put so in your story in the Post Tribune. What are some of the things that you had learned about him, not only his time working as well as a Lake County public defender and working in the courts as a magistrate?
Sure, yeah. He was, let's see, he did people's taxes for free for decades. You know, that's not something people usually enjoy doing, but apparently to him they were like a puzzle. He was a very reputable guy, very kind, a lot of friends, and you know, most people knew him because he was such a prominent magistrate and public defender. For example, the woman I talked to first met him when she was a young prosecutor, so they got to grow their careers together.
I know, too, that, and you have in your story as well, too, and maybe not many, maybe more people than we realize knew about this, but Mr. Page was a Freemason. He was served with one of the lodges, I think probably the one in Hobart or one of the area lodges. And in fact, he had made it through the succession of officers in the lodge to make it up to Worshipful Master, which is the top spot locally. If you go to a lodge, that's the person who is in charge of the lodge itself and the services that are held at the lodge. So he'd gone pretty far, certainly within the Freemasons that he had served with.
Yeah, how interesting is that? His half-brother, Paul Page, he told me that the Freemasons had been his own forte for a long time, and mm-hmm. Tracy Page kind of got involved with it later in life. But, you know, it seems that he moved up really quickly to become the worshipful master of the lodge. But also, his half-brother, Paul, said that activity sort of made them bond later in life. Even though they grew up together, they bonded over it. Later in life. And so, you know, Paul Page was at the trial too, and he spoke about Mr. Page as well.
What were some of the other comments that in talking to these friends and neighbors and colleagues that Mr. Page had worked with over the years that they had learned, I guess, from the testimony in court? Were there any surprises by some of the things that were brought out?
I don't think there were too many surprises, mm-hmm. Unless you think filing people's taxes for free is a surprise, which
well,
I do.
You had a good comment about that with one of Page's colleagues. He only Mr. Page only charged a rather nominal fee, or maybe more unusual fee, I suppose, for doing taxes, something that you wouldn't expect from H&R Block.
Yeah, yeah. It's a roast beef sandwich from Rosati's.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. Now, what is from what you know, and maybe you have the updates, so if there is anything here, when is the next time that the person who was convicted by the jury, William Lansky, expected back in to be, face the charges on the case, at least, that has come up from the trial itself? What's the next court date?
Sure. William Lansky is in the Lake County Jail, and he's there without bond until October 3rd when he's got a sentencing hearing. And if you want to hear about the sentencing, for what he was convicted of,
yeah,
he faces 45 to 60 years in prison. Now, if he had been convicted not of murder, but of voluntary manslaughter, that carries a lesser sentencing range. In fact, if you don't have any felonies before that, you could even just go on parole or house arrest.
Yes, the situation is very unusual, and probably if you're not familiar with Indiana criminal law, that's one of the interesting twists and turns that Indiana criminal law can provide. Although the sentences even now have changed over the years, but that's the way it is right now, yes.
Yep, and I think that that was the major point of deliberation with the jury, because they had to figure out whether William Lansky had planned to commit the act, or whether it was a sort of sudden heat reaction in the moment.
One of the stories that you have out in print and online as well, too, from Northwest Indiana, and covering in this case county government, because it was from the Lake County Board of Elections and Voter Registration, was one of the recent meetings. I guess the discussion came up here as we are in the local election season right now. Tell us about what a Northwest Indiana man is dealing with in trying to file a lawsuit here concerning the election board and trying to get on the ballot.
Yeah, so I'm new to the area, but already I've heard about a guy named Joseph Hero. He's an outspoken man from St. John, and he wanted to run for the St. John Town Council. But when he went to go into the primary election, some challengers came up against his candidacy.
And what did the election board do, I guess, that got Mr. Hero rather upset?
Well, they said he had to withdraw from the race. He couldn't be a part of it. And they said that because he was still under a 10-year ban from the Indiana Republican Party that he had received in 2016.
And what did Mr. Hero, I guess, have to say that you noted in your story that was the lawsuit that was filed by the Indiana ACLU?
Sure thing. You know, he said that he's been a Republican for 40 years. That 10-year ban came because he had supported two independent candidates in 2015. And he says he's recruited Republican candidates before. He says he considers himself a Republican. He says he's worked with them all his life. And so, therefore, he should be allowed to be in the race as a Republican.
What else was noted that you had in your story, and that you've looked in through the notes here, that the lawsuit that was filed by the ACLU of Indiana had to say in defense of Mr. Hero?
So they said that, you know, like many other Americans, Mr. Hero says he's open-minded. When he decides which candidates he wants to support, he chooses the candidate that he believes will best represent the community. So that's what the lawsuit said, and I think that's that's something, you know, a lot of people would agree with. They wouldn't want to be barred from a political party just because they might have supported a different person once or twice in the past, you know?
Now, in light of all of this, and you've mentioned in your story as well, too, what did Mr. Hero have to say about the possibility of running for public office again?
He was pretty adamant that it's going to be as a Republican. I don't really think there's an alternative for him at this point.
One of the other stories as well, we'll come back to it. I'll bring up another topic here before we finish up our conversation here of a newer case. But another story that you had was another case involving a former Lake County police officer, he faced some criminal charges of his own, but he's now decided that he's going to take up his case against a former Lake County sheriff and the sheriff's department in general. Tell us what John Brettweiser was concerned about and why he's in turn end up going in court again.
Sure. Mr. Brettweiser was concerned about basically the conditions that he worked under when he was in the Lake County when he was a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
And those conditions, I don't think he used the word toxic, but that's what they amounted to. He says he was pressured to, you know, ridicule colleagues. He was pressured to face embarrassing consequences if he didn't do certain things. And all that led to, eventually, a diagnosis of PTSD, which the lawsuit claims were aggravating to some convictions that he then faced.
Mr. Breitweiser, I understand, used to be a sheriff's deputy under the administration of a former Lake County Sheriff John Buncich, who himself now is serving a prison sentence for related cases. And you've had to do the research in that and, of course, getting your story together. What did you learn by looking not only at the paperwork that was filed in court by Mr. Breitweiser, but also it was the case itself involving Lake County Sheriff Buncich?
Sure. So Mr. Buncich is currently serving I believe it's a 188-month sentence in Missouri. He got that on counts of bribery and fraud, multiple counts of bribery and fraud. And so he was the sheriff that Mr. Breitweiser is referring to as creating these toxic work conditions that caused him so much mental stress, anxiety, and ultimately PTSD. Now, Mr. Breitweiser himself is not without his own charges, too.
Right.
Mr. Breitweiser in 2015 was charged with, let me get this right, searching through the documents right now, he pleaded guilty to battery resulting in serious injury. Now, that plea was part of a deal where other charges, including rape, criminal confinement, and strangulation, those charges were dropped.
Now, I guess his case that he has, I guess, against the Sheriff's Department and against a former Sheriff Buncich is filed in federal court in Hammond. Are there mentions in the paperwork that he filed in federal court, his lawyer filed in federal court in Hammond, about the type of behavior that, as a sheriff's deputy, he was encouraged to, I guess, that in turn it kind of led to the PTSD diagnosis. He seems to have been very concerned about not only his own condition, but I guess the condition of, I suppose, the colleagues that he worked with and worked under?
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, I guess one of the most telling things, which I actually did not include in the article, was that he was suspended for a time for, you know, such mental issues. And when he came back, he claimed to have been told by Buncich to suck it up and act like a man in response because the conditions were still the same.
We're talking with a Post Tribune reporter, and we should say a new reporter for the Post Tribune, but not to Northwest Indiana, Grant Morgan, about the stories that he's posted in print and online in the Post Tribune. One other story, and I'd like to bring it up here, the fact that it was in today's newspaper that you mentioned, it was about another case involving a former public official, about former Portage Mayor John Snyder. His case has come up, of course, before, and it's come up recently in like trying to get a sentencing set after Snyder was convicted of the bribery and some other tax-related charges against him. Tell us the latest here, I guess, that you noted in the paperwork in court and trying to get Mr. Snyder in court again for sentencing.
Sure thing. James Snyder was convicted in February of bribery and one other count, which I can't remember the exact name of off the top of my head. I'm sorry. It was obstructing the IRS. And so he got convicted, but he didn't get sentenced. Now he's asked twice now to push the date back where he will get sentenced. And the most recent story that I came out with was about that. So basically, he's scheduled to be sentenced on September 24th, and they want to push that back once again.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned that you were not new to the region, but you are, I should say, new to the region as a reporter. Tell us a little bit about yourself here, since this is your first opportunity to be on Lakeshore Public Radio, and what stories in the newspapers that you've worked for in the past?
Sounds good, yeah. I'm a graduate of the University of Akron in Ohio. I studied economics. I also went to the Public Affairs Reporting Program in Illinois, That's what I did just before this. I spent about 6 months covering State House news for a man named Charlie Wheeler. If you guys don't know who he is, he's a legend in Illinois reporting. And so then I got this job, and here I am.
Well, welcome to Northwest Indiana. Grant, we appreciate you spending some time with us here on Lakeshore Public Radio and regionally speaking to talk about the stories that you have out there. And we keep an eye out for you. And obviously, since you're getting involved with the Lake County government, with the courts certainly, I'm sure we'll have stories coming up here as we go through the budgetary process that Lake County Council is going to be dealing with in more detail here in the weeks and the months ahead before they have to pass some bills, or I should say some ordinances and like to get the money set aside for government operations going into 2020. Thank you for being with us today, and we hope to have you back on again soon.
All right, thank you. If I can make one more quick comment.
Certainly.
A big case that's going to be coming up is the trial of Samantha El Hassani in Hammond. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if anyone's listening, that's going to be, you know, a lot of news about that, and I think it will be a very intriguing read. So thank you for having me on.
Well, certainly. And we hope to have you on talking about that story as well soon. Grant Morgan is covering Lake County government and courts and the like for the Post-Tribune. Continuing on with Regionally Speaking's Reporter Roundtable Thursday. On this Thursday, let's check on news of education here in Northwest Indiana and around the state. Carly Lanich is the education reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And Carly, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
I know one of the new big stories you had out is the information that's come out from the Indiana Department of Education on the very first iLearn exam, and you took a look at the figures, and how did the school districts here in Northwest Indiana seem to fare?
Sure. Well, it's important to note when looking at this exam, it's the very first year the state is offering this exam. It's essentially a replacement to iStep that looks a little bit different. Statewide, the results were very, very low. We saw some of the lowest scores since iStep Plus was introduced about 4 or 5 years ago. Northwest Indiana, compared to the rest of the state, we saw a lot of schools on par with that. Some of our, you know, top performing schools did excel a little beyond the state average, and then we saw some fall in the lower percentiles as well. So there's been a lot of conversation here in Northwest Indiana and across the state now looking toward what do we do with this new exam and what do these numbers mean.
Now, from what the state has told you, what seems to be the mission of the iLearn exam as compared to iStep? Or is it pretty much just an upgrade to iStep, or is it something completely different?
No, so the state has been pretty forthcoming in saying this is not just a replacement to iStep. This exam looks a lot different, and the testing experience for students is a lot different. The major difference being students are now taking a computer-adaptive test. So rather than filling in, you know, those bubbles on a Scantron sheet, students are sitting at a computer, they're taking an exam that uses technology to base its questions based on performance throughout the exam. Education leaders have been very clear in saying this test is more rigorous. They brought in about 1,200 educators through the process of creating this exam, and they're using it, state leaders will say, to align with both national best practices and a statewide emphasis to focus on college and career readiness, which we're seeing even at the high school level of changing graduation requirements. So the test itself is now gearing itself more towards that post-secondary preparation and looking at how our students are preparing for what's next after their K-12 school.
I understand, too, this is probably a better change for bilingualism, too, because it's easier, I guess, for people that understand Spanish and or English or both can take this exam.
Yes, yes. So that was something the state introduced for the first time, a new component on, I want to say, the math, science, and social studies exams, that there is a Spanish translation for those exams. I've been told there's also a glossary of terms in other languages beyond Spanish as well for certain tests to really help those English language learners through what can be a tricky situation taking a standardized test.
Now, give us a little breakout on some of the information that you got from Northwest Indiana school districts, how they did on the iLearn. As you mentioned, it's a first time only for everybody, I guess, in this case. What kind of response have you gotten from checking around the school districts in the region about this very first set of numbers?
Sure, sure. So It's probably easiest if folks are interested in seeing their individual school. We have a breakdown down to the individual school building of how your school did. If you want to visit our website at nwi.com, mm-hmm. you can check and see your school and the individual test proficiencies. So we're looking at everything from English language arts to math to science. We have a complete breakdown of that on our website. As far as what I'm hearing from schools, we're hearing a lot of mixed feelings from educators. They're, with everything that's new is a time period of getting used to that new exam. So some of the things we've heard from teachers is some students have been taking a long test, sitting for hours on end taking this exam. Some others have reported that the standards that were being tested were a little bit different than what they had expected coming into it. And from the state's perspective, that was to be expected with a test that is more rigorous in that preparation for college. So now what we're hearing educators talk about is, you know, now that these scores are out, now that we know how our students performed, what do we do in the next year or so not only to mitigate the effects of these results, because they're tied into really important pieces like teacher compensation and school evaluations and accountability, but also what do we do in the near future to prepare for the next set of exams, which will come next year.
And I also know, too, that they had a chance to hang out with the superintendent of public instruction, Dr. McCormick, here, and she came to visit Northwest Indiana Schools. Tell us about that story that you had in the Times.
Sure. So last week, right around the time that the state was gearing up to release these results of iLearn, Dr. McCormick made a visit to Susan Hobart in the morning and met with some folks at the high school there, and then made a stopover in Hammond and visited both Hammond's new dual language program at Irving Elementary School, and then also took some time to meet with educators and students and answer some of their questions, not only about iLearn, but general topics ranging education right now in the state. So there's mm-hmm. a lot of talk about teacher compensation and the structure of the Department of Education and what the school superintendent does. So it was really an opportunity for the community here to interact with Dr. McCormick as they're elected as school official.
I know that you noted that she wasn't particularly happy with the governor's commission that is looking into teacher compensation. And I guess they finished up their last public listening session. So I guess now it's a matter they'll just have to get together and do some brainstorming, eh?
Right. So that's been an ongoing discussion at the state level as well. There's a lot of folks who recognize that teacher pay in Indiana isn't quite what it should be, and there's a lot of folks brainstorming how can we do this better. The commission held its last meeting, I believe it was last week. The closest to us was in Elkhart. There has been some conversation about the Department of Education in Indiana was not included as a voting member on the board that's seeking to present some solutions to the governor ahead of the next budget session downstate. But there is a way for folks to provide some input if they couldn't make it to those meetings via the commission's website, which is something I'm sure we can link to and let mm-hmm. folks know that this is a way that your voice can contribute to this ongoing conversation.
Okay. Carly, one of the other stories that you had was an education-related story, although it was probably more of a question about a personnel issue, perhaps, or at least we think so anyway. That was the story involving the former school safety director in the school city of Hammond, David Safstrom. Tell us what, as best as you can tell right now, that's all about and how the story is progressing.
Sure. So the information we've received from officials is very limited at this point. What we do know is confirmed via law enforcement officials that there was an investigation into this individual. We don't really know the nature of that investigation, but he is since that time retired from the school city mm-hmm. in Hammond. That's really as much as we do know. We know he did work as a volunteer officer in some capacity with the county, and he has since been removed from that position as well.
Well, I guess it's one of these cases where maybe we will find out what's going on and maybe not, I suppose, unless there's something related that may come up in the investigation, too. I guess the school district is still officially looking into it, too. Is that your understanding?
You know, the school district has been quite hesitant to confirm the investigation themselves. That's something that we had heard from law enforcement officials. So at this point, what I've been told as a matter of reference from the school's attorney is that they're not commenting on the matter at this time.
Well, I guess that's one of these stay tuned moments, I suppose. We'll just have to wait and see if anything more develops into that. And we thank you for that and the other stories that you put out here in the Times recently. And we hope to have you back on again soon, Carly.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Carly Lanich is the education reporter for the Times. This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Andrew Steele covers transportation and a lot of related issues for the Times in Northwest Indiana. And he is with us today to talk about the stories that he has out there in print and online. And one big story I know in particular is dealing, of course, with the South Shore Line. First off, Andrew, thanks for joining us on the show today.
No, thanks for having me.
Well, if you will, give us a little update here, if there's one to give, certainly, on the South Shore Line expansion, because we know it's kind of broken down into two major components, the double tracking and then what is being called the Westlake Corridor Project. Bring us up to date on that and how things are coming along in the grand scheme of things with that.
Okay, well, engineering work and planning work continues on both, and the local officials here at South Shore continue to work with folks in D.C. at the Federal Transit Administration. Westlake Corridor, as you know, is a 9-mile extension from Hammond down to the Munster-Dyer town line. Right now, the projected cost is about $816 million. So they'd be looking for just under 40% of that to come from the feds, which makes them very interested and very much involved. Right now, with Westlake, they are anticipating moving into what's called the engineering phase of the project.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in order to get to the engineering phase, you've got to have about a third of the engineering already done. And so they're at that stage now, and we'll be looking to move to that final phase before they would be considered for a grant agreement. And so they hope to do that soon, and then next year maybe move into position to negotiate a grant.
Now, I know that's also, too, the most controversial, apparently, of the two. We know a lot has been talked about there in Hammond in particular and going down through into Munster and Dyer and all where the south terminus would be. And a lot of people are very pleased about this, and a lot of people are very unsettled about this, too.
Yeah, and especially as you move south, there have been some protests along the way. It seems to me, just from my observation, that people have pretty much accepted that this, assuming a federal approval, that this is going to happen. And there's been some work done. You know, there's going to be a station near Ridge Road in Munster, and that was moved based on a lot on what residents wanted and what the town wanted. It's moved north of Ridge Road from the original plan to put it south of Ridge Road.
Well, I know there's always been concerns about traffic issues in particular, and since that area, as you know, you travel there in the vicinity of Calumet Avenue and 45th all the time to get to the newspaper office, it's a real traffic issue, and we know they're doing the work there because of the traffic issue. So you would think, and maybe more people are realizing, that maybe putting a train line down that way and get the commuter service down there would actually be a benefit.
Yeah, it would... especially and the route to Chicago, whichever route you might take. I mean, it would help alleviate some of that traffic. And then, you know, the train itself, there aren't going to be a whole lot of trains. They're going to move through the communities pretty quickly, so they won't back things up too much. So, yeah, overall, it should be good for traffic.
And now the double tracking is the other part of the overall project. Tell us about that and how that's standing, too.
Yeah, that one, right now... NICTI is waiting on a rating from the FTA. So they have like a 5-point scale to rate the projects. You need to have a medium or better, so right in the middle or better.
Mm-hmm.
Westlake already has this rating, has a medium-high rating.
Yeah.
And they are hopeful that double track will get the same, and that they're hoping for that this fall. And they're hoping that double track 2 can move into the engineering phase this year as well. Double track, of course, is... about a 25-mile project area between Gary and Michigan City. They're going to add 16 miles of new track to double track. That's why where it gets its name, the railroad between Gary and Michigan City. And also Michigan City, they're going to eliminate 20 grade crossings. They're going to move the railroad out of the middle of the road, so a lot of safety upgrades as well on that project.
One of the important parts of the entire project, both lakes, we should say, is trying to do development or redevelopment, as the case may be. That would be in Hammond, of course, and points to the east for the line, and south, of course, as we said, going to Munster and Dyer. And one of the things I know that has been discussed before, and I think the latest story that you have does cover that in more detail, is the question of transit-oriented development. First, kind of explain what that is and where the folks at One Region and its organizations within the structure are offering up a very special idea for helping finance that kind of development.
Yeah, transit-oriented development would be, generally speaking, mixed-use development, which would include housing and retail and restaurants and other businesses in the immediate vicinity of rail stations. So something you see in Illinois and all the suburbs. Mm-hmm. A lot of them have had really big population growth. And increased incomes and increased housing values, and that's what they hope to see here along both Westlake and then the South Shore. Obviously that takes a lot of money, a lot of private money, and one of the things One Region has done is start to put some of that together. So, you know, their loan program, they have five banks that have pledged $5 million each to a $25 million fund to help, you know, sort of kickstart some of the private development around the stations.
I get the impression that this particular project, where they have this this pledge of $25 million for putting out loans to the developers that want to take on these redevelopment or development projects, is a pretty important part of the start to how these neighborhoods are going to be able to cope with extra trains coming through and extra train lines. In this case, this the Westlake Corridor project that doesn't have any trains going through it right now. They're going to probably enjoy whatever development is there. And also, too, I know this has a lot to do with the overall goal that NCTE has in wanting to make sure that there is plenty of opportunities for people to live close to the train, so they in turn will use the train, I guess, especially if they happen to work in Chicago.
Yeah, one of the key words we see a lot from not just One Region, but all the folks who promote transit-oriented development is walkability. And they want, just sort of like you would have if you lived in the city. You know, you don't even necessarily need a car. You can walk wherever you need to go. And that provides convenience. It also tends to increase the safety of neighborhoods and just the general vibrancy and activity in a neighborhood.
I know that this particular financing project that is being proposed here within the One Region organization is not the only thing that's out there that developers can use as incentives to put up these big projects they want to do, whether it happens to be high-density housing or commercial or retail development, is there?
Yeah, right. And really, probably the main organization dealing with this right now is the Regional Development Authority. Mm-hmm. And they will be in charge of setting up what's called transit development districts. Those are going to act a lot like a TIF district would, if you're familiar with that. They're going to take the incremental growth in property and also income taxes within the district and be able to use that money to leverage private investment. And then they're working right now on drawing up these TDDs, as they're called, and they're looking at things like the federal opportunity zones, state programs for tax credits for investors. So they're looking at all the ways these things overlap and can contribute to one another.
I know your story in particular mentions the fact, and some of this conversation has already come up too, about the idea of doing this development very close to the new station, any future stations for the South Shore Line, and the existing stations too, I guess, where it can be done. A quarter mile, that's pretty close to the train lines. And what seems to be the intent, is there some kind of opportunity maybe for land that's available and be able to use that properly?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a big part of it is, you know, using buildings that are already there, or taking a vacant lot and building something new. And, you know, the focus of a quarter mile is kind of a general guideline for this One Region program.
Yeah.
But, you know, it really illustrates the point that the way they want to start this, the people who look at TOD, is you really want to concentrate around those stations and then let things ripple out from there through the economy.
In talking to the folks with One Region about this, what kind of timetable are they hoping that can get some of these projects with the developers going? Have they mentioned anything yet?
there's not really a timeline because it obviously depends on the developers themselves. And for developers, you know, there are opportunities now along the line. So who knows? People might be looking right now at, you know, Hammond or a Miller, or and Michigan City is doing a ton of work right now trying to promote it. But, you know, in terms of especially like Westlake, people need some degree of confidence that, you know, it's actually going to happen, and when it's going to happen before, there's going to be a lot of money, I think, committed.
Well, Andrew, it sounds like it's an interesting concept, and we'll see as the South Shore Line expansion projects continue as what actually does develop about this. And we thank you for talking with us today about the story that you had out there, and we'll talk with you again real soon.
All right. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Andrew Steele is transportation reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. A Northwest Indiana healthcare company, InHealth Integrated Care, is part of the response team that is helping the victims of Hurricane Dorian. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson talked with Ron Donahue, who is the CEO of InHealth Ambulance, about the company's sending some of their associates down to one of the areas in the United States that's affected by the storm.
Tell me about what you are doing. I understand you're sending some ambulances down to Georgia. And tell me a little bit about, you're based in Valparaiso. Tell me about what your company is.
All right, so it's InHealth Ambulance. We have bases in Lake Porter, LaPorte, and St. Joe County. And we have a partnership with FEMA and AMR. And any kind of natural disaster that happens around the country, we typically get called upon to send ambulances to. This will be our fourth hurricane in 3 years that we've gone to. And, you know, they called us yesterday and put us on alert that we might be deployed. So at that point, we kind of get volunteers from our staff that's willing to go. I mean, they get paid, but they are going to be gone for up to 2 weeks, you know, away from their families. And it's a pretty big commitment to just kind of drop everything and go. So about 2:30 or 3 this morning, we got the call that they've made the decision to send, you know, resources down there in preparation for the hurricane. They're expecting it to be pretty bad. So we had like 4 hours to get everybody ready. So we've got four associates going down and two ambulances. We're heading to Georgia. The crew is heading to Georgia now. And once they get there, then they're going to be deployed on wherever they feel the hurricane's going to make landfall. So that, you know, it's kind of hard to say where that's going to be at this point, but they do think, you know, mid to southern Florida, sometime on Sunday.
And your company is based out of Valparaiso?
That's where our corporate office is in Valparaiso. But we have bases in Highland, LaPorte, and South Bend as well.
So you said you have four associates going down?
Yeah, four associates and two ambulances. So EMTs going down. And, you know, this morning we had the mechanics come in and make, you know, check over the vehicles, make sure everything was good, and then also, you know, stock up on extra supplies and oxygen. And because they could be, you know, out doing calls back to back for 24-hour periods. They could be back at Air Force bases. It really depends. Each time we go, it's a little bit different, just depending upon the emergency. So they have to be pretty self-sufficient. They've got, you know, extra food and supplies and toiletries and all that to make sure that, you know, they're taking care of themselves while they're out there taking care of the patients too. It'll range from nursing home evacuations to just helping people out of their houses, you know, kind of whatever the community needs. And our crews do it and we do it. You know, we know that when we had the floods years ago, people came in to help us in our communities, and that's kind of why we do it. And each of the crews go through specialized, it's called NIM, so it's National Incident Management Training, and it's to, you know, people will be working together from all over the country. So this training kind of makes it easy for them to communicate and understand, like, the hierarchy and, you know, structure when you're dealing in these big mass casualty or mass injury types of scenarios, just how everybody interacts with each other. So we go through this training throughout the year to be prepared for these situations. And, you know, I've got the crew's been texting me pictures. One cool thing they just sent me was that they're now in a convoy with another group of a tree cutting company, because they know there's going to be power lines and trees down. So now kind of all these emergency vehicles are kind of finding each other and traveling together. I know in the past ComEd and NIPSCO and all those guys have gone. So they've just sent pictures of the ambulances with these tree cutting places.
That's Ron Donahue. He's the CEO of InHealth Ambulance based in Valparaiso, speaking with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. Industry and East Chicago have gone hand in hand for more than a century, and nowhere is that more evident than in the city of East Chicago's historic planned worker community known as Marktown. The neighborhood is sandwiched in between the massive steel plant and the nation's BP refinery. And the company for years has been buying up homes and businesses and buildings in Markdown and clearing them away. Many remaining residents want to leave too, but they say that BP has not really offered them anything that's worth their home's value. And Michael Puente offers this look at what's happening in the historic neighborhood near the refinery complex.
Ricardo Maldonado offers coffee and pastries to his neighbors. They gather in his dining room last week to discuss their homes and their future in this neighborhood called Marktown. It was built more than a century ago by industrialist Clayton Mark so workers could live near his factory. Marktown's unique Tudor-style English homes are listed on the National Register of Historic Places. But let's not over-romanticize this place. Although the rent and home prices are affordable, it can be hard to live here. It's isolated from the rest of the city of East Chicago. No grocery stores, no schools within walking distance. Residents say the worst part is the air quality. That's Olivia Chalwance. She's lived in the neighborhood with her husband Juan and their two children for 7 years. She says in Spanish, who wants to live here near so much contamination, the contamination and the odor. Here, Olivia says she prohibits her children from playing outside because of the pollution. Olivia says she and her neighbors want to move, but BP isn't offering enough money for their homes.
This house, you know, I paid $30,000 and I put $20,000 because I fix it.
This is Ricardo Maldonado, whose house we are in. He bought his home 14 years ago, and he thinks it's worth much more now.
And I don't think it's fair if they offer me 30, you know. I think something fair is around 50 or 60, something like that.
BP has offered, in my opinion, a very unjust an unfair value that goes from $20,000 and in some cases $30,000.
Juan Villarreal is a licensed real estate broker who's representing 26 of the remaining 60 or so homeowners in their dealings with BP. Marktown once had more than 200 homes and duplexes, but many have been torn down over the years and their occupants relocated. Villarreal says some homeowners aren't allowed to talk about their dealings with BP. They often make decisions in the dark.
Sometimes we're given an ultimatum by brokers that represent BP, suggesting that if they didn't take the offer now, which would be on an average of $20,000 to $30,000, that they would be lucky if BP would even offer them half. And so there's a lot of scare tactics.
BP's Director of Media Affairs, Michael Abenhoff, says in a statement that the company has been purchasing property around the refinery for more than 20 years in an effort to create more green space. That means clearing away the historic structures and potentially displacing residents. In his statement, Abenhoff says in all cases, the properties were purchased from willing sellers. Where there were safety hazards, BP had the purchased properties demolished or removed, he says. Abenhoff insists BP always negotiates in good faith. East Chicago City Councilman Robert Garcia, who represents Marktown, thinks otherwise.
BP just don't understand. Them homes might not be worth much, but a lot of those residents and homeowners have their homes paid off, and that's priceless to them.
The company hasn't said why it wants to clear the homes, but local environmental activist Thomas Frank has an idea. He says after the fatal explosion at BP's Texas City refinery in 2005, the company wants a buffer between its facility and residential areas.
They're mitigating against the potential for a blast.
Frank says it will be difficult to find a home anywhere for the amount BP is offering.
Where do you go from Marktown? And you're just not going to find a home that you can buy at $14,000 and not have to pay enormous amount of mortgage.
Marktown homeowner Juan Rivas faces that real possibility.
Si no, ¿para dónde nos vamos a ir?
He says, where are we going? With $20,000, we won't get anything. I'm Michael Puente.
There's going to be a new festival coming up on September 7th at Founders Square in Portage. Not only bring entertainment together for people who will come to the event on Founders Square, but also to help people in Porter County. With us to talk about it, we have one of the organizers and sponsors of the event. Jamie Cloud is with Melendi Handmade, and she's with us to talk about it. Jamie, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we understand that this new festival that's going to be coming up here on September 7th in Portage is going to be a full day of activities and events that are going to help raise money for Christmas gifts for people, for families in need in particular. Fill us in, if you will, and tell us about the problems that are now existing in Porter County this way. And I guess the incentive to able to organize such a busy day of activities just to help out.
Well, I know there's a lot of different giving trees and organizations out there that do give Christmas gifts to families in need. But I wanted to make sure that we were actually doing something that was going to impact the local community and know that all of the money that's raised is going to actually be used for charity. And so I partnered with Brendan Clancy, who's going to assist with helping to find families that are eligible. And then we also have a link available on the Facebook event page where families can sign up if that's something that they're interested in and they have a need this Christmas season.
What have you been told or what have you experienced by living there in Porter County of problems that families are having these days, trying to keep up with the situation as it is and that need the help extra?
In speaking with Mr. Casper, who is the manager at the Porter County or the Portage Food Pantry, He stated that they used to cater to families that fell just below the poverty level. But at this point, there's such a need in Porter County, in Portage specifically, that they had to only allow families to be eligible if they fell two times below the poverty level. And I know that, you know, in the past, personally, as our family has sponsored children at our children's schools and gotten them Christmas gifts, and I really wanted to develop something that was going to make a greater impact in our community because I love Portage. I've lived here most of my life. And I also wanted to create a community event and try and make this an annual festival.
It seems like that you didn't have a lot of problems convincing very many people to help out. The information says you've got more than 50 vendors, including art and craft vendors. And, of course, there's going to be a lot of entertainment, music, and the like on September 7th there in Founders Square. So a lot of people certainly feel very strongly about this, like yourself, that want to do something to help.
Yes, and we do still have some vendor spots available. If anyone's interested, they can call us at 219-508-1161, and there are other opportunities available in that avenue. But we've had great response from the Portage High School. It's going to be sending some volunteers from the ROTC team. We also have several different sponsors that are providing advertising. Paranorman Now is providing advertising, and then we have Nativity, who's providing the fencing. So we've had a lot of great response from the community.
It seems that we have also had some good response from some of the folks that are going to actually putting on the entertainment that day, too. It gets pretty busy sometimes to book acts and bands and the like together, but it appears that you didn't have any problems in getting the entertainment lined up for this festival.
No, not at all. And actually, so Dixie Crush is out of Illinois, and they're known very well here, and they're very excited to come out, and they performed at Founders Square before. And then Stern Approval is a local band, and they were more than willing to jump in and assist. And I know, you know, the time frame was a pretty tight time frame, and so I'm very thankful that they were able to take time out of their schedules to assist with this event.
That's great. Now, this event, again, is going to happen on Saturday, September 7th, and it'll be at Founders Square in Portage. And so, obviously, you have help from the city of Portage to get things lined up for handled the traffic problems and the parking problems, I imagine. What kind of things do you recommend to residents and visitors coming into Portage that want to attend the festival this next?
So if you want to attend the festival, there is parking around Founders Square, and then there are also local businesses around there that will be closed during that time that you can also park at. So entry fee is a donation of $1 per person minimum from 2 to 4, and then the bands start up at 5 p.m., so from 4 p.m. until 11, it's a minimum donation of $10.
It sounds like, Jamie, that you and a lot of other folks working very hard to get this September 7th festival going in Founders Square are really looking forward to a chance to be able to raise as much money as you can to be able to help so many families in need in Porter County for this holiday season coming up. It's probably pretty gratifying, makes you feel good to know that so many people are right behind you to want to help out all the way. Now, if anybody has any questions and they'd like more information about this, how can they get a hold of you in advance of the September 7th festival?
So if anyone's interested in being a sponsor, you can sponsor a family for a minimum donation of $200, mm-hmm. and that family will be notified that you are their sponsor. You can also make any monetary donation that you would like, or you can volunteer. And you can contact me, Jamie Cloud, at 219-508-1161 with any questions about sponsorship, volunteering, or vendor opportunities.
Well, Jamie, it sounds like that you're well on your way, along with you and the other organizers of this very special first ever day of festivities on Founders Square in downtown Portage to help families in need in Porter County in the holidays coming up. Thanks for being with us to talk about it.
Thank you so much, and we hope to see you there.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Our thanks to Grant Morgan with the Post-Tribune and Carly Lanich and Andrew Steele with the Times, to Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson, and to reporter Michael Puente as well, too, for the pieces that they've offered up today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll be back with you on Monday.